The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Thursday edition. And as we all know, that anyone who knows football, who really knows football, would cash out on an accumulator if they were relying on West Ham to beat Chelsea, or if they were relying on West Ham to beat anyone for that matter. But that's what West Ham did. Who shows Yarmolenko inside? Antonio Rudiger, that's who. A huge win for the Hammers while the rest of the bottom sides just wander about aimlessly. Norwich continually passing it to Aubameyang. Bournemouth letting Newcastle score four, brackets F-O-U-R, close brackets. Elsewhere, Bruno Fernandes helps Ole find the wheel again, and Leicester's lockdown extends onto the pitch. There's plenty of Football League as Wigan go into administration, and we'll discuss the report into racial bias in football commentary. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, David Heitner, a long-awaited pod debut. How are you, Dave?
This is a big moment for me, Max. We're over the technical glitches. I'm excited.
It's a longer-awaited debut because it's taken you about 2.5 hours to make your Zoom work, and you can't even see all of us. But it's been quite exciting for the rest of the panel. Jonathan Liu, how are you?
Oh, very well, thanks. Yeah, how are you doing?
Yeah, really good. Did you get any feedback from the life and times of Jonathan Liu, or have people stopped listening to Football Weekly?
No, quite a few people. I mean, more of a mailbag than any other show I've done. I mean, people seem to be kind of vaguely interested in Countdown and racial bias and commentary and run-ins with famous footballing personalities than I thought.
Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
First question, Barry, is from friend of the pod, Barca Jim. And it's, how does Barry feel about sports betting?
I think it's a pernicious, malign influence on the game. I've always maintained that.
What happened yesterday?
I won £971 on an accumulator bet involving all four Premier League matches. I don't want to glamorise betting in any way. I had a 10 quid accumulator. And it so happened that Arsenal, Everton and Newcastle all won, which meant it was all riding on West Ham to win the final game. Of course, they were outsiders. I didn't think they had a hope. I didn't even think I'd make it that far. But so I decided to hang on and not hedge. And it all came good. Yeah, it was great.
Johnny, West Ham were, I mean, Antonio was brilliant yesterday. I mean, the way he set up that goal, but his whole performance yesterday I thought was superb.
Yeah, I mean, they really did a job on Chelsea. I mean, I was at the Chelsea Man City game last Thursday, and David Moyes was sitting two seats in front of me in a mask, sort of furiously taking notes. And you know, you could see what he was thinking in hindsight. Slightly weak on set pieces, slightly bristle in defence, can be got at, and vulnerable on the counter-attack. And that's it was a Moyes master plan that did for them yesterday.
Dave, did you give West Ham any hope before the game?
Absolutely not, no. I was actually at the Leicester-Chelsea game at the weekend, the FA Cup game, and Even though Chelsea played very poorly in the first half, they found, you know, Lampard made his changes and they totally turned the game round and took a real grip on it, looked good. All the momentum was with them. I remember saying this season, I think my intro was something like, this season is now set up for glory for Lampard and Chelsea. And you could just see the pure rage in Lampard when he was interviewed afterwards. Just so frustrating. And Johnny's mentioned the set pieces. That's the defensive set pieces. It's just been a problem all season. And, you know, Rudiger, Alonso, you go through the whole back four and it was just a disaster class for them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had games at centre-back like Rudiger against Antonio where basically all you can do is keep fouling the player and for just as long as you can and then look innocent at the end. But I suppose, yeah, I want to give credit to Antonio because I think that role is really hard to play, especially in a team that are, you know, putting 10 men behind the ball. And I just thought he played it brilliantly, Johnny.
Yeah, I mean, partly it's, you know, the centre-backs have a real handful when they're trying to deal with him. But it's also, I mean, if you're playing against a player who's in that sort of form, who's really, I guess, dominating you in the way that Antonio was, you need a tactical solution to that. And Chelsea just weren't able to stop West Ham getting the ball to him. if a player is proving that influential, you need to find some sort of way of cutting the supply lines to them, and Chelsea just really weren't able to do that. And that's kind of it's sort of the story that we've been talking about with Chelsea since the start of the season, right from the very first game when they got hummed to Old Trafford, that when they're in transition or when they're countered, their midfield sometimes just seems totally non-existent, and it's just so easy to play the ball through them. And that's what West Ham found last night. I mean, it wasn't just the counter-attack that Yarmolenko scored at the end. They were so open on so many occasions, and that's kind of been a recurring theme in Chelsea's season, despite what this recent run of form has kind of done for their confidence. The frailties have always been there.
And that's weird because they've got N'Golo Kante. So you sort of think if there's going to be a team that are quite hard to play through or bypass in midfield, it'd be one with Kante.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about this after the Leicester game on Sunday, that there's been a kind of confusion over what Kante's role should be. And I mean, if you think about all the teams that Kante's played well in, Leicester in 2016, Conte's Chelsea in the first season, and France at the World Cup, they're all teams that have essentially been counter-attacking teams. They've played a large proportion without the ball. I think Conte's Chelsea were sixth for possession in the season they won the title. So again, not a heavy possession-based side. And there's a question mark over whether that's the style of play that really suits Kante best. And if you're trying to play, on the other hand, a front foot attacking possession-based game like Lampard is trying to play at Chelsea, where Kante fits into that? And I think that's a question that he's still trying to answer. I mean, in the last few games, he's put him back in central defensive midfield, in front of the back four, having played further forward earlier in the season. Yeah, I think that it's a puzzle they're still trying to solve a little bit.
Barry, would you like the VAR chat to start?
Yeah, please do. Go for it, Max.
Okay, so West Ham went 1-0 up. Well, it was chalked off for offside. Thomas Suchek, who really has come to prominence since lockdown, not a player that I spent a lot of time thinking about, but has been involved in a lot of West Ham-y stuff at the moment. It took 3.5 minutes to decide that Mikel Antonio was offside. He was lying in between the ball and Kepa Arrizabalaga. West Ham fans still this morning suggesting he's not interfering with play at all because he's not in Kepa's eye line. I felt, Barry, that he was offside, even though it was very sad and it was sad for everybody. And I can understand why everyone's upset, but I think he was offside.
I don't know to the letter of the law if he was offside. He was certainly in an offside position. He was lying on his back on the ground after a passage of play. I don't think he was in Kepa's eye line. If anything, the fact that he was lying on the ground took him out of Kepa's eye line. I thought it was a incredibly harsh decision, and if it takes that long to arrive at that decision, then I don't know. I hate VAR, and this is another reason why I hate VAR. I wish it wasn't in the game, but I honestly don't know whether that goal should have been chalked off or not.
Does anybody know?
Honestly, Max, I'm pleased you've said that, because I totally agree with you. I was like, that's offside. He's lying between the ball and the goalkeeper in an offside position. It was very sad and really unfortunate. But, the guy's offside.
Is he interfering with play? The hoary old, if he's on the pitch, he must be interfering with play, one aside. I don't.
I say yes. He's lying there.
Yeah, he's lying between the ball and... I mean, James does say, if you lie down between Barry and the bar, are you interfering with his attempts to buy a drink? But like, he is... I understand that, look, Kepa can see the ball, but there is a big man lying in front of him between the ball and him. That's surely... You've got to be in play there, surely.
But Max, if you lie down between me and the bar, the only person being disadvantaged in that scenario is me. You're hampering my efforts to get to the bar. The barman can still function perfectly well, but my efforts to get to the bar are different. You're in my way rather than the barman's way.
I mean, it's almost philosophical discussion, isn't it? I mean, this idea of whether somebody is interfering with play. I mean, we're talking butterfly effects here. We're talking, is if a player is lying in front of a goalkeeper, does it interfere with their field of vision? Or would they? I mean, it's almost a metaphysical question, really. Would Kepa have acted any differently had the player not been lying in front of him, prone on the ground? It's impossible to say, and that's the kind of the pickle that the laws have got into. They are getting themselves into questions of philosophy and metaphysics and butterfly effects and alternative parallel realities. And frankly, 3 minutes is a pretty decent amount of time to clear all that up.
James says, when a beautiful free kick curls around the wall and goes in off the post, is there anywhere a goalkeeper can stand that would make Gary Neville happy? Barry.
Well, I'm not sure to what criticism he's alluding there, but the Willian free kick was just sensational. He got a little bit of luck, but I'm not sure there's anything a keeper could have done to keep that out. I think it would be harsh to criticise the keeper in that situation.
And Dave, who shows Yarmolenko inside? I mean, it's in the Arjen Robben Andros Townsend list of players that you just don't show that way.
Just a very, very bad decision. When Yarmolenko cut inside, I was just thinking, where's Rudiger? It felt like he was 5 yards away from him all of a sudden. As I think Antonio said after the game, the second Yarmolenko is inside like that on his left foot, you know the ball's going in the bottom corner.
Can we, Johnny, just ask about Chelsea next season? Because I've got this image that I really want them to keep this defence, add Werner, Ziyech, you know, perhaps get Havertz in as well, and be a bit like a 2021 Ozzy Ardiles Tottenham.
It's incredible and baffling at the same time. So, you know, you have Werner and Ziyech, who you imagine will play on the left and the right, respectively. You still have Abraham. You have Hudson-Odoi. You have Pulisic. You have Mount. You have Kovacic. You have Ross Barkley. You have Loftus-Cheek. And I don't really understand how it's all going to fit together. I mean, I think Werner and Ziyech are going to be an incredible duo. But again, I think it's the back five which is the area of concern there. This season, they've conceded more goals at this stage of the season than any Chelsea side for 23 years. And I think rather than trying to sign Kai Havertz or whoever else that they're trying to get, I mean, the centre-backs really have to be a priority in the transfer window.
All right, let's move on to Brighton, Manchester United. Two for Bruno Fernandes, one for Mason Greenwood. Dave, you were there.
I was there, and I was actually thrilled to watch United, which really hasn't been said very regularly in recent years. The impact that Bruno's made has just been absolutely outrageous. I don't think any United supporter could have dared imagine that he'd have had such a transformative impact on the team. And I look at the lineup from the Amex Stadium with Pogba, getting his strut back, controlling things. Matic has been unbelievable since the return to action. And then the front three with so much pace, so much threat. It actually felt like a proper United performance. And an evening when you really thought, my God, you know, are they back?
Are they back? I mean, Andrew says, providing they can add one or two more players, do you think they could challenge for the title? Was that going a step too far?
I think it feels like a big thing to say, but I think they need another centre-half to play alongside Maguire, because I'm still unconvinced about Lindelof, to be honest. Baye is a player who I really like, but I think that he makes too many mistakes. I think if they could sign another centre-half, they've got a 1-11 that could challenge and has proved that even this season, which has been frankly a dreadful season on balance across the piece, that they can on their day beat the big teams. It's the sort of mid to low ranking teams that United have routinely slipped up against this season.
Mason Greenwood, Johnny, is a very exciting player. Just the way his speed of his feet with those step overs and taking the finish so early, he's got so much promise, hasn't he?
Yeah, there's the impudence of youth. I mean, cliche alert, but there's a real the way he just wants to slam the ball in at the near post is I think it's extremely indicative of this guy. He wants to run in straight lines. He wants to beat players, and he kind of wants to do it all himself, which is a good trait to have most of the time. I guess the main difference between this United and United from the last few years, I mean, for all the differences that Moyes and Van Gaal and Mourinho had, what they all shared in common was a kind of a very structured approach to how they wanted play built. You pass here, the ball goes here, and this is what you do. What we're seeing under Solskjaer, especially now Pogba and Fernandes are both fit, is do what you want. Make your own solutions.
Dave, on Zoom, you've raised your hand. Did you just accidentally click a button, or do you have something you
I was going to actually just say further to what Johnny mentioned about Mason Greenwood's directness, which I think everybody loves. I think the real directness actually starts with Bruno in the middle of the park, because when he gets the ball, his ability to ping those low passes forward, passes that you actually don't even see from high up in the stands where we're sitting, and then you're nodding along thinking, that was a great decision, Bruno. And it just energises everything. There's options. They can still counter at pace, as they did with the third goal, which Bruno scored so brilliantly. But most importantly, they can actually unpick deep-sitting opponents like Brighton on Tuesday. I'm not saying Brighton are Brazil or anything, but the fact is they're not a team who get rolled over very often. United got hold of that game early, played through them with all sorts of variation, and having Bruno and Pogba in the team just makes the world of difference.
Moving on to the Everton-Leicester game before we finish part one, I actually wondered if Richarlison's goal was a nicer, defter move than that Fernandes goal, because I thought Luca Dini's little cushioned header was great. They kept the ball for a while. Gordon's cross to Richarlison hitting the ball at pace, I thought, I would say that might be, and maybe I do have an agenda here, Johnny, a slightly nicer goal.
Yeah, I mean, I what I liked about that was there was a kind of geometric perfection to it. If any of the sort of half dozen things that in the build-up to that goal, if any of them isn't kind of a millimetre to the other side, then that goal doesn't get scored, right down to the finish, where I think it's Chilwell who's trying to come in and stop Richarlison. Richarlison literally gets half an inch in front of him, and that's the space he needs to slam the ball in. I find those kinds of goals aesthetically pleasing, more so than like a 35-yard pile driver, for example.
A little bit of VAR, Barry. Would you have given that handball against Wilfred Ndidi?
Yes. Don't agree with the rule, but it was a handball, and I'm surprised it took them so long to award the penalty, to be honest.
Matt says, would anything speak of a post-lockdown return to comforting normality more than Everton completing their late-season surge to the Everton Cup? And they look good, don't they, Barry? And at the same time, you know, Leicester's form has disappeared.
Leicester's sort of season going off a cliff has been quite a surprise. I can't put my finger on what exactly has gone wrong, but the players just don't look particularly interested. And Brendan Rodgers seems fairly unhappy. He's complaining about the fact that he's constantly having to give them rockets at half time to get them going in games, which suggests his players perhaps have their feet up and aren't really that fussed about qualifying for the Champions League. I don't know, but and obviously Jamie Vardy's. The goals drying up for him is a big problem for them.
Did you see Ancelotti's press conference afterwards where he got asked about Luke Garbutt?
Tell the story, yes, tell the story. I think it was before the game, was it?
Was it before the game? Sorry. Well, somebody asked him like, oh, why have you let Luke Garbutt go? I mean, he's just left the club. And Ancelotti's like, who? And then there's like some furtive whispering with the press officer, like, Luke Garbutt. I'm sorry, I don't know. And I think Luke Garbutt found this and he tweeted, like, I think he tweeted an emoji with it, which is a nice moment.
Well, what it was, Luke Garbutt's been on loan at Ipswich, I think, all season, so, or certainly since Ancelotti arrived. So he had a showreel, basically, of his Ipswich best bits, which he put on Twitter and said, hey, Carlo, look at what you're missing.
Does anyone have any strong feelings about Leicester still playing at home on Saturday, despite the lockdown for the rest of Leicester? Or do we presume because... Carry on, Barry.
I don't have strong feelings that they shouldn't be playing at home. If Leicester is in lockdown, Leicester shouldn't be playing football in Leicester. A race meeting that was held at Leicester Racecourse on Wednesday or Tuesday night, that shouldn't have taken place either. But it's just indicative of the mixed messages we're getting from the government here. The Leicester footballers are probably very healthy. They're being tested, and the King Power Stadium would probably be the safest place to be in Leicester, but it's all about optics, isn't it? But the boat has sailed so far out of the harbour at this stage, it doesn't really matter anymore.
Dave?
I think it's exactly that, though, Barry. I went to the King Power on Sunday, the day before the city was locked down, and there's no question that it's the safest place in town. Unfortunately, or whichever way you want to look at this, the Premier League have lots of money. They have spent lots of money making everything completely safe, utterly sterile. You could not be any safer. You drive in, you don't see anybody. From a journalist's point of view, you're walking into a press box, which has been wiped down to within an inch of its life. You're sitting nowhere near anybody. You plug into a Zoom post-match press conference and you leave. I don't really think that there's two... optics is one thing, but if you're looking at actual practicalities, I think that it's right that they carry on playing at home, or totally fair enough.
That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll round up the rest of the Premier League and we'll talk EFL too. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. At the Emirates, Arsenal 4, Norwich 0. I mean, not a huge amount to say about this game, Johnny, apart from you probably shouldn't pass the ball to Aubameyang if you're a Norwich player.
Yeah, I mean, I really like Norwich, and I think they've been a breath of fresh air. Another cliche alert, but I like the way they play, and they go through long phases where you think, okay, well they've had a little spell of possession. Oh, they seem quite secure. And they just literally pass the ball to an opponent and concede a goal. They've had a few chances. They've had a bit of possession. They look like they're getting. They conceded again. They're putting us too fast together. They've had a few chances. Tim Krul has literally just dribbled the ball straight to Aubameyang. And it's the same with quite a few teams at the bottom, actually. For all, their virtues and for all the occasionally nice football they've played, it's just this tendency to brain fade so often. And that's why they're going to go down.
Aubameyang's the fastest player to reach 50 Premier League goals for the club. Actually, when you say that, it sounds like he's just the quickest at running. not the first one. He's the first one to get there. What would you do if you were Aubameyang, Dave? Would you hang around or would you go somewhere else?
If I was him, I wouldn't sign anything yet. I'd run it down. And you can always sign before leaving. You don't. When you enter the summer of free agency, I think everybody thinks, well, you have to leave. You don't at all. Just stick around, see what's going on. I'd definitely give it another year if I was him. Not that I would ever be as talented a footballer as him. If I was Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, I'd want to see whether Arteta can impose his blueprint and actually move the club forward, because he's onto a good thing, Aubameyang. He's got a great life in London. Everybody loves him. He's a superb footballer. Patience, give it a little bit of time.
Our mate Elliot Ross said, it's great that Bukayo Saka is staying at Arsenal. He's signed a contract. But he said, but it's a sign of how the club is being run, that expectations are now so low that keeping an 18-year-old who's been at the club since he was 8 is made to feel like a massive milestone rather than simply routine housekeeping. Is that a fair representation of what's happening at Arsenal, Johnny?
This is a guy who's just checked wiki page 31. He's coming to, I guess the last 4 or 5 years of his career, and the guy's won virtually nothing. He's won, I think, a German Cup at Dortmund and a couple of runners-up medals, and that's pretty much it. And so I guess the question for him at this stage of his career is, does he have the time, I guess, for another long rebuilding project, which is I guess what he would be signing up for at Arsenal. I mean, Saka signing on is I guess a positive sign, but Saka's at a completely different stage of his career. He can afford to invest in this project. Aubameyang's 31. I don't know where he's going to be in a couple of years' time, but if he doesn't see Arsenal winning trophies or challenging for trophies in the next couple of years, I wouldn't blame him for wanting to move to somewhere with, I guess, a bit of short-term chart of silverware.
Where does he go?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there's not going to be many takers in this market for a 31-year-old on his wages, but he can still do it. I mean, he can still, as we've seen, he's still got an incredibly good goal output, and it's not inconceivable that somebody will like that.
Bournemouth 1, Newcastle 4. Let's bring in Ben Fisher, who's going to talk to us about the EFL, but he was at that game, so it would seem silly not to talk to him about it. Hey, Ben.
How you doing, UK?
Yeah, very good, thank you. Bournemouth have lost 15 of their last Premier League matches. You know, if you're conceding four at home to Newcastle, something is up, isn't it?
Yeah, quite worryingly, Bournemouth made Newcastle look a little bit like Brazil. And I have to say, though, Newcastle, they get a lot of stick. You know, they're not renowned for their slick football, but Newcastle were very good, but Bournemouth were oh so very bad. Very worrying times for Eddie Howe in Bournemouth. The next four games, Manchester United, Tottenham, Leicester, and then Manchester City. So I'm sure those guys will go nice and easy on them. But no, in all seriousness, it's pretty bleak. And last night was just atrocious, to be blunt with it.
Did they just look bereft of confidence?
Yeah, first goal goes in after 5 minutes. And from that moment, they're just totally zapped of everything. And I don't know. They looked resigned to relegation, which is not good with six games to go.
Ben, you're quite close to Bournemouth and spend a lot of time covering them. What do you think has gone wrong? Is it a case that the players have just tired of listening to Eddie Howe?
I don't think that is the case, Barry. I think simply that they've got a problem in creating chances, and putting your finger on that is easier said than done. But the bottom line is people who were scoring goals and putting up, you know, teeing up chances last season, have not been doing that this year. David Brooks has been a big miss, but I don't think you can just say, oh, you know, David Brooks is not on the team, so let's forget it. Certain players probably, maybe, I don't know if they're at full tilt, how much of that the lockdown plays a part, but again, every team could make the same excuse. But defensively, they've never been great, and Eddie Howe alluded to that earlier this week, but normally they've sort of counteracted that by being really good going forward and creating chances, but that element is totally vanished.
I mean, Newcastle's goals were really lovely, weren't they? Shelvey's pass for Lazaro, the fourth, was inch perfect. Almiron's run was great, and it was a glorious finish. Dwight Gayle got his 100th career goal, and Sam Maximam's run to set up Longstaff was excellent, and he's such an exciting player. Does he look better in the flesh?
I was going to say, Max, I don't think too many players I enjoy watching more than Alan Saint-Maximin. What a player. He went on at one point on this sort of mazy 80-yard run, just brushing people off with ease. And he's a really good player. I genuinely don't think I enjoy watching anybody more than him at the moment. Live, just brilliant, brilliant player to watch.
There's the same kind of buzz around him as there was around Adama Traore, I think, when he was at Borough. And Sam Maxim, he came with a reputation as a troublemaker, and, you know, punctuality was a problem. He was very raw, they said, but he is still raw. There's a lot of potential to harness there, but he's been quite the purchase. Although I believe he's signed on a very, very long contract for some reason or other. But I'd imagine if Newcastle wished to get rid of him at some point, which they probably will if Mike Ashley is still in charge, there'd be no shortage of takers.
Here's a question from Matt, who's a Newcastle fan. He says, from someone who's new to being 4-0 up, should I be angry at Isaac Hayden missing a sitter when we're cruising, or should I laugh it off and smile? That miss was of sort of Ronnie Rosenthal proportions, wasn't it? I was so pleased to see it, like, spoon. And not just, like, a tiny bit wider over, just completely. It was like a clearance.
Yeah, that's the thing. It should have been 5 or 6 before, obviously, Dan Gosling pulled that goal back. And just on Saint-Maximin, felt a bit sorry for Adam Smith, because last Wednesday, he's up against Adama Traore. Wolves prosper, get the goal. And yesterday, he has a thankless task of keeping Saint-Maximin at bay. So I don't know, well, Manchester United up next, so yeah, it doesn't get any easier.
Do we think on that Hayden miss, Johnny, that it's not as bad as Rosenthal's because Ronnie Rosenthal was in complete control of the ball? He had taken the touch before and there was no one anywhere near him.
I think it's harder than it looks to, I mean, notwithstanding the fact that he should probably have buried it, but it's harder than it looks to kick a football that's moving across you. You know, Rosenthal's is obviously it's the genesis. It's, you know, and in the beginning was the word of football misses. And, you know, every so often you see, like, you know, you say, well, how has he missed that? It's surprisingly hard to kick a football in the right direction, especially when it's moving reasonably quickly. And I totally sympathise with Isaac Hayden there. It's exactly the sort of thing I've done a million times. I mean, join the club.
I would like to state that it isn't hard to kick a football in any particular direction. It's actually quite easy.
If it's moving across you, you have to, you know, you've got to judge the angle, you've got to judge the pace, and you've got to divert it in a totally different direction, right?
Johnny, if you're running through on that chance, what's your XG?
I mean, I think it's somewhere between 0 and 0.5. On a good day, I reckon I'd bury that half the time.
All right.
Max, if I could just interrupt briefly here, go off a slight tangent. I remember talking to you after you had participated in a media football match in Ukraine, I believe.
I know where this is going.
And you said you were amazed that a couple of people who had been representing the British press pack could be so good at writing about football, but also be so bad at playing it. One of them is on this screen. Would you like to?
I said that, you know, when I was in full belief that, you know, Johnny Lou would just take the Athletic's shilling and I'd never have to be in a conference call with him. To be fair to Lou and Miguel Delaney, I believe that they weren't at peak physical powers because of the night before.
You can't be bracketing me with Delaney. Delaney, who started at left back, made one run into the centre and never moved. Didn't bother going back to left back. I mean, I had an engine at least.
That's true. And look, the Ukrainian team had two former Ukrainian internationals in centre midfield. But I did feel like, you know, insert any pundit going, you've never played the game, Brian. Anyway, on to tonight's fixtures. Man City play Liverpool. Do we want to have a debate about guards of honour, or can we let that just slide because it doesn't matter really?
Well, I heard the Danny Murphy rant about guards of honour and how nobody wants to do them and should have to do them, as it happened on TalkSport, and I didn't think much of it. And then it seems to have got a lot of traction, with a lot of people thinking Murphy was bang out of order with his suggestion that guards of honour are an unnecessary waste of time. I mean, if it's tradition, just do it. It doesn't really matter. I wouldn't particularly object to either getting one or having to stand in one.
As someone who's against all ceremony in football, I think that there's a danger that you kind of go down a slippery path here, because, okay, fine, guards of honour is fine, that's the tradition. Then just one day somebody throws rose petals and then everyone's got to throw rose petals. And if you don't throw rose petals in front of the champions, you are disrespecting the league, you're disrespecting... And I just think, you know, just it's gone too far already.
But actually, you know, Danny Murphy was... It was part of a long conversation where at some point he said, look, you know, some of the Liverpool players who are going to get a medal aren't fit to lace De Bruyne's boots. Taken out of context and, you know, put of a photo of Danny looking miserable next to, you know, a picture of Trent Alexander-Arnold and Mane and Salah, then you can, you know, if you don't listen to it, it's just a classic example of why social media is just really annoying, because it was... You know, it was quite a reasonable chat they were having. And then it, you know, he goes home or just he's on the seventh tee. And then, you know, people just start saying he should never be allowed within 200 miles of Anfield again. Sheffield United play Spurs tonight. Then you've got the weekend, Norwich, Brighton, Leicester Palace, Man U, Bournemouth, Wolves, Arsenal, Chelsea, Watford. Sunday, you've got Burnley, Sheffield United, Newcastle, West Ham, Liverpool, Villa and Southampton, Man City. Shopworn Galahad says, Bayern have paid $41 million to get Leroy Sané when he could be free in 12 months' time. What is the economic thinking here? I wondered the same when Liverpool effectively paid $35 million for 1 year of Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain. Is the idea, Dave, that you want to get him and no one else can? I presume
Him in the building immediately and start enjoying him. And yeah, make sure that nobody else gets him. There's all sorts of agreements that are struck clearly between the agents and the clubs and guarantees. Yes, my client will join you in a year's time. And then we all know that they don't. So I think it's just a pure insurance. If he wants to come now, just pay the money, get him. It's not, for a player of Sané's quality, it's actually not that much.
Let's talk about the Football League. Ben, Wigan have gone into an administration, the first English professional club to do so since the pandemic began. The EFL have said Wigan will be deducted 12 points. The sanction will be applied at the end of this season if they finish outside the bottom three after 46 games. Should Wigan finish in the relegation zone, the penalty will be applied during next season. I guess, A, this is incredibly sad for Wigan. That's the first question, and how they've ended up in this situation.
Yeah, horrendous situation. And I spoke to somebody there yesterday and they just said, look, it's happened sort of stupidly quick, which I suppose is stating the obvious in some senses when, let's face it, they got taken over, I think, a little over 4 weeks ago. So how this evolves is quite frightening. It shouldn't happen, especially on the back of Berry and everything before and after that. We shouldn't be getting into these situations. I think it's unclear here how much the pandemic and things have played a part. It's not good enough. People point the finger at the EFL. It's not stringent enough in terms of they let sort of people in the door, and then it's sort of time to ask questions, and that's not good enough. But equally, it almost feels like the EFL aren't big enough or strong enough to take this on. I don't know if there's some other kind of intervention that can be at play here. But yeah, desperately sad.
We will at some point do a special on, you know, how to save EFL clubs, because it's a big conversation and it's a complicated one. I mean, the Championship, Ben, Leeds held by Luton. Lovely goal by Luton, wasn't it? Which is a bit of a slip. West Brom win again, but still those two very much in the box seat, even with Brentford flying at the moment.
Yes, massive result for West Brom. How they needed that last night at Sheffield Wednesday. I think the interesting thing here is a little now beneath that, the playoff race is still really interesting. It just seems like it's made for Wayne Rooney to lift a trophy in an empty Wembley, doesn't it? I don't know. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. And at the bottom as well, since the restart, the teams that entered the lockdown in the relegation zone are just picking up wins and results for fun. I don't think Luton, Barnsley or Charlton, none of them have lost yet since the restart, which is staggering, really. Although that Wigan news is a bit of a shot in the arm for your Hulls, Stokes and Huddersfields.
Preston, the first team to play 5,000 football matches. Johnny, which was your favourite of those? Let's read out the whole list of them. We should talk about the playoff final, League Two, on Monday night. Northampton smashing Exeter 4-0. It was very straightforward. A big fan. Northampton are very much get it in the channels, knock it long. It's what Wembley was designed for, isn't it? But well done to them. And Dean Moxey's red card was an absolutely brilliant moment of, I'm just bored of this. I'll just go straight through someone.
Yeah, I mean, League Two was great. And Northampton sort of, they had a disastrous start and then they came up trumps. I mean, the long throw, like you say, get it in the mixer, beautiful. But they were a lot more than that. You know, they were efficient. They were very good at what they did. And Exeter were on the ropes for a long, long time.
And people will have forgotten that the League One has playoffs. Who's playing? It's tomorrow night, isn't it, Ben?
Yeah, it starts on Friday, second leg on Monday. You've got Fleetwood versus Wickham and Portsmouth v Oxford. And an interesting mix of managers, Gareth Ainsworth, Joey Barton, Carl Robinson, sort of exciting managers at the earlier stages of their career. And then you've got Kenny Jackett, Wiley sort of got the T-shirt manager. So let's see what happens.
Who are you picking out of those four?
Personally, I'd love to see Wickham go and do it. It would be a great story. I think Portsmouth have a chance.
Ben, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll focus on this interesting story about racial bias in football commentary.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Just a little European roundup for you. Lionel Messi scored his 700th goal of his career, but Barca were held by Atletico. Real can go 4 points clear if they beat Getafe at home tonight. In Italy, all the top three won. Inter hammered Brescia 6-0. Juve and Lazio both won away matches at Genoa and Torino, respectively. Juve 4 points clear with 9 games remaining. This story about football commentary and racial bias, I thought it was really interesting. It's like the first proper report into it. And this is from Sachin Nakrani's piece in The Guardian. Racial bias is a clear and significant problem in English football commentary. According to this study, which found players with a lighter skin are regularly and overwhelmingly praised for intelligence, work ethic and quality compared with those with darker skin who are reduced to physical and athletic attributes. It was carried out by a Danish research firm called Run Repeat, and the first aimed at understanding whether the football media talks differently about players depending on their skin tone. More than 2,000 statements from commentary on 80 games across the Premier League, Serie A, La Liga and Liga were analysed. Lighter-skinned players widely praised for intelligence, 62.6%, hard work, 60.4%, and quality, 62.7%. Commentators also 6.59 times more likely to talk about the power of a player if he has darker skin, and 3.38 times more likely to reference his pace. Johnny, what do you make of it?
Well, I think it's it's not exactly groundbreaking in that there's been plenty of academic research, especially in the United States, on this particular phenomenon. But I think it's encouraging to have this hard data in football to prove what I think anecdotally we've known for a lot of time, for a long time. And this is the sort of phenomenon that I think has repercussions throughout the game. Like, language is incredibly important in the way we talk about people. And the perception that black players have primarily brought athleticism to the game rather than intelligence or decision-making skills is something that has knock-on effect. It's explained, for example, why there are so few black coaches or black owners. It potentially explains why the pathway into the game is defined by scouts who are looking for certain traits in certain kinds of players. It conditions what we see. So I think it's incredibly important. I mean, I'd be interested to know what you guys think of it. But I think it's a quietly important step in sort of recognizing the way that we all, and I definitely include myself in this, that we all talk about football and footballers and how we need to kind of moderate and scrutinize the way we do that.
Clive Tilsley, the ITV commentator, had quite a bit to say about this. He seemed quite intrigued that no study of this kind ever seen, or, you know, specifically into football commentary in the UK has ever been done before, and made the quite interesting point that a lot of co-commentators take up that role without having any sort of formal training or guidance whatsoever. And, you know, they're talking on the hoof on live television. It's very easy to say something that you might regret or ill-advised. So maybe these players should have some sort of just guidance. You know, be careful what you say or think about what you're saying. And it's an interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, Clive Tilsley also made the point about feedback, and I think that goes, you know, in I don't know how long I've been broadcasting, sort of 17 years. Almost never has anyone sat me down and replayed a piece of radio or a piece of TV to me and said, look, not just on this subject, on any subject, to say, you know, this worked, this didn't work. I think a couple of times early on at Sky, people did that. But then you're very much just left to your own devices. And that idea is, you know, that's just one piece of anecdotal evidence. But I suspect that happens a lot, so that people just get, you know, it's like bad habits anywhere, right? People just get used to them. I thought what was really interesting about this study was I kind of wasn't surprised about the things about pace and power. I sort of knew that existed, and that yeah, not just commentators, everyone in the industry are sort of lazy about those kind of stereotypes. The ones about hard work and intelligence, I actually just didn't realize that they were so stark, actually, and that may have gone into my subconscious when I'm looking at a player, for example. You know, if you look at Paul Pogba, right, he's clearly so skillful and so talented, and he's also quick and powerful, right? You know, they're not mutually exclusive, and that was the piece of the report that I found really interesting.
I think the interesting thing as well, if you look at a player like, say, Lukaku, who, as we all know, is immensely powerful and is rightly praised for his power. But if that's the only thing that's defining his career, that's when it does become sort of quite insidious and quite problematic, because as we all know, he's a quality finisher as well, for example, and has a range of other attributes.
But actually that hard work thing is interesting, because if you think of like Moussa Sissoko, and you know, he might not have the best touch in the world, but there is a player that works incredibly hard, right? Is non-stop. And if that is never discussed, if it's just the power aspect of Sissoko or the pace aspect, but you don't actually say, look, there is a real diligence to that player. There is a player that in the 94th minute is still busting a gut. And we're conditioned to just talk about hard work when we're talking about, you know, I don't know, Lee Catamol or something. That's where it is, does become a problem.
Well, it goes beyond that as well. I read a really interesting interview with Carlton Cole a few weeks ago, and he was basically saying that, you know, there is this stigma that black players can be lazy. So, and he was aware of that during his playing career, to the extent that, in his own words, quote, I made sure I ran enough, and sometimes as I wasn't running smart, I'd be like a headless chicken on the pitch trying to look busy. And that's no good.
Well, that when it has an actual impact onto what players are doing on the pitch, I mean, that's striking, isn't it? Johnny, you wrote a piece about to crowd noise or not to crowd noise, and I enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. I think we should probably introduce some kind of appropriate sound effect there, like wild cheering or something. I mean, I don't actually, I mean, personally, as a matter of personal taste, I don't mind crowd noise that much. I mean, I played FIFA, I played Pro Evo growing up, so I'm sort of used to it. It's just, I find it interesting where it's going in that a crowd is so much more than a noise, and yet to package it up and just sort of paste it over a broadcast was quite interesting. And like, if you're gonna have fake crowd noise now, then maybe in a couple of years time somebody says, well, the atmosphere is a bit flat, why don't we just add a little bit extra. And that's something that you see in a lot of other sports, like, you know, rowing. Do you know in rowing they add the noise of the water? The sound effects are added in. Horse racing as well.
Yeah, I was astonished to hear that about horse racing. Apparently it's the soundtrack by the hooves of galloping buffalo.
Yeah.
What? That's a bit like The Simpsons, you know, when they're doing a film and, you know, they paint a horse black and white so it's like, looks like a cow. So what you're telling me that when I'm watching, when the Abinyali brothers are tiring and the Searle brothers are coming through, that is not the water I'm hearing someone in a back room in TV Center just splashing around in a bath,
basically. Yeah, TV lies to you all the time, and this is just one of the other ways in which it does so.
Josh, does anyone think that we should still have away ends and the away team brings their flags to put in the away end? We could debate if a strong away flagging affects performance in the running. Players would have somewhere to run when they score a last minute winner. It's a great idea, Josh, and we'll pass it on to the Premier League. Did anyone see anything from the Danish Cup final last night? It was suspended for 14 minutes as a group of ultras refused to obey social distancing. Aalborg and Sønderjysk, hopefully I pronounced that correctly, were each given 725 tickets for the final at the neutral Esbjerg Stadium, as long as they sat 1 metre apart. But just before the half an hour mark, a group of Aalborg fans grouped together and refused to move, despite pleas from the club's coaches and others' fans. They were kicked out of the stadium and their team lost. I mean, completely ridiculous thing to do. We should say congratulations to Viviane Miedema. Has been named the Football Writers Association Women's Footballer of the Year. She's an utterly brilliant footballer. She missed out on the award last season by a single vote. She beat Chelsea's Beth England by one vote to win the 2020 accolade. And finally, have any of you seen this? Rangers legend Lorenzo Amoruso will take part in an Italian reality show called Temptation Island. It's based on the concept of Love Island. The show is designed to test the strength of a couple's relationship as they compete to prove their love can pass the test. So Lorenzo and Mrs. Lorenzo will be split up for 21 days amongst other couples. The men spend their time with 11 single women and the women with 12 single men. Each couple's journey will end with the host, Filippo Bisciglia, asking, do you want to leave with the person you arrived with? It is, for our Italian listeners, is on July the 2nd on Canal 5 and is filmed in Sardinia. Barry, would you like to wish Lorenzo the best of luck with being honest and honourable and faithful?
I'm already feeling very nervous for Mr. and Mrs. Amoruso and all the other couples involved. It sounds a hideous proposition, but good luck to Lorenzo.
That'll do for today. Dave, thanks for coming on.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Johnny.
Thank you.
Cheers, Baz.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.